of you know Gail Irwin? Any of you know Gail Irwin, author of Jesus Style? No? No? No, no of him. That's what I meant. Okay, yeah. Ever heard him share? Oh, my goodness. I hate to say this because I hate to quantify and rank things, but let me just say one of the, I'll say it that way, one of the better humorists in the body of Christ, and someone who understands Jesus' nature, like I still hunger to, you know? When I first transitioned smoothly from my role as a pastor in a church, reading between the lines, that means I got fired by my best friend, okay? You read between the lines. But as I transitioned slowly from local church life to dinging around with people from all over the world, one of the things that really bugged me about that was one of the things that I think you all deal with. When I would be at camp in times past and hear these people are learning music, they're going to sing every night for the next 2 years of their life, you know? How do you do that? I didn't even like teaching. What I liked about, there's a lot I didn't like about being a local church, holy man, guru type pastor dude. But one of the things I did like was that you were on a journey with a group of people and you didn't have to talk about stuff you'd talked about before. You could just keep talking about other stuff. When I spoke to multiple congregations on Sunday mornings, where you'd speak and there's like four congregations, you know, and you're supposed to do the same thing four times because nobody wants to miss anything. I couldn't do it. So I would do the same content, but in four different ways. I would arrange it four different ways just so I wouldn't get bored. And I was talking to Gail Irwin one day when I was making this transition. I said to Gail, because he does a Jesus-style seminar. You can get it on tape off his website, servantquarters.org. You can get it off his website. But he does a thing on the Jesus style, the 17, I think, attributes of Jesus. That's just incredible. His book is called The Servant Style, I think. The Jesus Style. It's about servant leadership. It's called the Jesus Style. Anyway, and he does the same shtick every weekend of his life. Same thing Friday night, same thing Saturday morning, same thing Sunday morning. He just does this in churches and groups all over the world. The exact same thing every weekend of his life. And I was talking to him one day and I said, you know, I was remarking on that. I said, I just don't know how you do it. I don't know how I'll ever do it. I don't know. I can just, you know, because when I go somewhere, people want to hear about, you know, the naked church, or want to hear about the vineyard, or want to hear about He loves me, or want to hear about something I've written about, or heard me teach. And so I find myself saying similar things over and over again in all kinds of different places instead of different things to similar people. It's now the same thing to different people. And I was saying that to him. I was saying, I don't even know if I can handle it. I think I'll get bored. I was just kind of whining a little bit. And Gail was just so cool. He just said, oh, so ministry's still about you. And it didn't hurt that bad when he said it. It didn't. I mean, so ministry's still about you. And I kind of went, oh boy, that didn't sound good. I think, thank you, Gail. And, he just couldn't have said it any better. That was the truth of it. Oh. Well, so ministry's still about you. And I was like, well, yeah, of course it's about me. It's my ministry. God called me to this me, mine. It's me. Yes. That's what I wanted to say. Fortunately, I was too holy to make that kind of, too falsely holy to let that out. But, you know, it's like that manipulation thing we read it a minute ago. It's one of those statements that just gets in there and mucks with your head and spirit for about, I think, what was 7 years ago he said that to me? That changes you. It changes you. Look at Mark chapter 10 with me. One of my favorite passages. Mark chapter 10, I'm going to begin reading about verse 32. And they were on the road going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was walking on ahead of them, and they were amazed, and those who followed were fearful. And again he took the 12 aside, and he began to tell them what was going to happen to him, saying, behold, we're going to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered to the chief priests and the scribes. They'll condemn him to death, and he will deliver him up to the Gentiles, and they will mock him and spit on him and scourge him and kill him. Sounds like a fun retreat. We're going to go up to Jerusalem 3 days and get the crud beat out of me, and later we'll rise again. And the very next paragraph, look at this. Here's what I'm about to go through, is what Jesus is saying. I'm going to go up there, and it's going to be frightful, and I'm going to get killed, and I'll rise again the third day. And James and John, two particularly sensitive brothers, James and John, the two sons of Zebedee, came up to him and saying to him, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you." And he said, "What do you want me to do?" Now, they're kind of like kids, aren't they? Promise me you'll say yes before they ask you what it is. And that's kind of what they're doing. Promise you'll say yes. And Jesus saying, okay, what is it? Here, and in the midst of Jesus saying, look what I'm about to go through, they're saying, grant that we may sit in your glory, one on your right and one on your left. Now, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? I'm going to go up there and die. And you know what James and John got out of that? Not, oh, really, poor you, and oh, man, can we help? And I can't imagine what you're going through. What was their first thought? He's going to die. If we want to get our request in, we better get in fast. It was all about them, wasn't it? It was all about them being first in the kingdom. We want to be first and second. We want to sit on your right. It's time to go for the best places at the banquet because he's going. He might be dying on us here. Isn't that weird? The moment he was most in need of their love and support, all they could think about was themselves. Isn't that amazing? And how do we use this kingdom to get us? What is it about us and our flesh that needs to be best, needs to be first, needs to have most, needs to... I hate to say this to you, while you were down here working and rehearsing hard, I went on a long walk with Jesus this morning, two other brothers, and a set of golf clubs, okay? And we're out there, and it's just something, you know, what is it about us that's got to win, got to be first? I mean, I guess golf wouldn't be fun if you didn't care how many you took. A couple holes, it would have been more fun if I could have gotten there on those holes. Like, I didn't care that I'm getting an eight. But they made me play the country club from the blue tees. If you play golf, you know that's just a horrible way to play any golf course, from the blue tees, much less the country club. Anyway, and in the course of thinking that through, but just how much we want to be first, how much we want to be the best, how much we want to have the most, they're on that page with the kingdom, just how we are. And Jesus does a kind of a, I guess it's a funny little deal. So Jesus says to them, "You do not know what you're asking for. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink, or to be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized?" And don't you love the way Jesus talks about stuff? And nobody knows what he means, but everybody's willing to answer him anyway like they do. Except for Thomas. Thomas is the only guy that says stuff like, "What are you talking about? I have no idea what you just said." James and John are just kind of like, okay, we want first and second in the kingdom. He's asking us, are we willing to drink the cup? And you know, if you're sitting at the king's table, drinking the king's cup, yeah, that sounds good. You'd be baptized with the baptism. Oh, yeah, we saw John Duncan, sure. If we can be baptized, we can do that. He had no idea he's talking about dying. Because he really is talking about dying. And they have no idea, so they're volunteering. And they said to him, "Yeah, we are able." Verse 39, and Jesus said, "Well, take cup I drink, you will drink." Boy, don't you hate that. "Cup I drink, you will drink, and you will be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized." There's a lot of baptizing going on in that sentence. Jesus sometimes needed an editor just to fix all that baptizing going on there. "But to sit on my right or on my left, this is not mine to give, but it is for those to whom it has been prepared." Now, that's kind of cheap. I like it. Can you drink and be baptized? Yes, we can. Well, you will. But it's not mine to give the seats. So you get the bad stuff, you don't get the good stuff necessarily. And then here's a lovely moment. "And hearing this, the ten began to feel indignant with James and John." Now, why are they indignant? Why do you think they're upset? They didn't ask first. One of the immutable laws of the universe, if you call it first, you get it. I mean, who trains kids to think like that? But my kids were thinking like, they were calling stuff, and I'm like going, who taught them to call stuff? We called stuff. I was third of four brothers. I get the comics first, or I get shotgun. Hey, when you call it, you get it. That's the way the world works. So when they're like, okay, they called it. So they're upset. They're upset that they didn't think about it first, that they didn't ask. And I love the moment. You'll notice so much of Jesus' teaching. This illustrates the point I want to make, the second of these three things I want to talk to you about. Most of Jesus' teaching didn't come because, well, you know what? It's Thursday, May 9th. And according to my junior discipleship palm pilot, we're supposed to cover leadership today in the body of Christ. Or we're supposed to cover anger issues, anger management issues. Or we're supposed to. Jesus didn't do that with his guys, did he? He didn't have his little curriculum, you know, hanging in his big binder, hanging around one of these. Okay, guys, let's see. It's May 9th. We're going to have to cover today. Oh, yeah, here it is. Here it is. We're going to talk about leadership in the body of Christ. He didn't do that. So often, the things he talked about was right in the middle of what they were wrestling with. Right now, he's got a pair of boys that are just greedy for the whole deal. He's fixing to die, and all they're thinking about is what they can get out of it. It's kind of like going to your father's deathbed saying, how much is left in the inheritance? It's just not the best moment to ask those kind of questions, is it? That's what these boys are doing. The other 10 are angry at the other two because they didn't think about it first. And they don't understand the baptism cup thing either. So they don't understand, but they're indignant. And so here's what Jesus does, and he does this so well. In the moment when the issue has arisen, let's talk about it. Let's not schedule. You know what we need? We need a 3-week conference on leadership. Or, well, you know, tomorrow night, I'm going to do a sermon on that. In the moment, hearing this, they were indignant, and calling them to himself, Jesus said to them. Now, I'm going to read the next 1, 2, 3, 4 verses, because this is, if you'll notice the red letters, if you have them, this is the sum total of what Jesus wanted to say about leadership right here. Somebody got a stopwatch on their wrist? Somebody got a stopwatch? Anybody? Okay. Go ahead. I want you to time how long this sermon was. I'm going to just read it. And will you time it for me? And Dan, at the end of that, we're going to know how long Jesus decided they needed to hear about leadership. And then, gosh, if I was like Jesus, I would be done, but I've got to fill another 45 minutes, so I will. Ready? Here we go. You know that those who are recognized as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them, but it is not so among you. But whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant, and whoever wishes to be first among you shall be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. How long was that? 24.82 seconds on leadership. And you know, when you do stuff at the moment it's most needed, that's about all you need to do. Jesus didn't tell him everything he knew about leadership. Just didn't launch a leadership seminar with them. He said, you've misunderstood something. You think this works just like the Gentiles work it. That leaders exercise authority and leaders get their way. I'm telling you, in this kingdom, the greatest among you is the slave of all. And then he does something that I think is just incredible. Even the Son of Man didn't come to be served, but to serve. If anyone had the right to come and ask to be served, don't you think it would be the King of Kings? I mean, if anybody, forget us, we're humans. This is God incarnate, God in the flesh. If anyone's got the right to come and say, look, I'm God, I'm living among you, and I want you to serve me, he's got the right to do it. And yet he's saying, that's not my mentality. I didn't come to be served. And here's the deal. What it means to be one of those in whom Christ is taking shape, the language of Galatians 4:19 that we talked about yesterday. Here's one of those things. That it's not people, it's not dragging people into my world. It's going into theirs. To be where they are, in the moment they are, saying the thing that will most help them make next steps in what we talked about last night, letting people have their journey, not becoming the fixer, not that you're going to make people conform to your last lesson in the kingdom, but you're going to let God take each person you know on the journey they need to go on to be transformed, and you're looking to encourage that journey, not conform them to your way of thinking. And now, another step in that process, go deeper. Don't ask them to come to your world. Go to theirs. Don't ask them to serve what you need to survive. I grew up with a very fragile spirituality. And I think it has to do with that second road we talked about. How many remember the three roads yesterday? Let's do them again. What was this road? Wickedness, rebellion, evil, self-indulgence. What was this road? Righteousness from what? Works, human effort, righteousness of the law, all that talk. And what was this road? The righteousness that evidences itself in you as you're learning to trust who He is. The righteousness that comes from faith. Now, I grew up on this road of works righteousness. I grew up on this road of human effort, trying harder for God. And you know what? When you're on this road, one of the things we teach people is righteousness and spirituality is a very fragile thing. And it can you can so easily be led astray, so easily distracted by the toys of the world, so easily led astray by the appetites of the flesh, so easily corrupted by your friends who are, if they're not godly friends and friends who are choosing God's life, it is so easy to lose this life here on this road. That we grow up as Christians not ready to serve our culture. We can't even be with our culture. We can't be where they are because if we're there, we're going to get enticed because this spirituality is such a fragile thing. And the reason we said that was because we saw many people on this road sucked into the world. Did it for a while, backslid, drew away the world, sucked them in into alcoholism or drugs or free sex or all the kinds of stuff. We saw that happen. So what we learned, the ethic was, man, you just got to hem your life in and you've got to protect yourself. And, you know, it's hard working with people who swear and take the Lord's name in vain. And you just can't be where people are doing wicked stuff. And so we try to create this world. And yeah, I'm going to make a little political commentary here because I just can't resist it. Because most of the political appetites of the religious conservative in our culture is bent on changing the culture to conform to our way of thinking. And does this sound like we're serving the world? Aren't we in effect asking the world to serve us? You do what we think is best for you so that we'll have it okay. Let me tell you something about this road right here, this road of faith-based transformation or faith-induced righteousness or however you want to say it. Spirituality in this road is not so fragile. You don't lose it easily. And once you've embraced this kind of transformation, I'm telling you what, the world has nothing to offer you ever again. That's what Paul said. I came to the cross and I died to the world and the world died to me, Galatians 6:14. I used to read that scripture on this road of self-righteous works and go, what are you talking about? The world died to you? The world hasn't died to me. I've come through the cross. I know what the world offers, and I want it all. But I'm being a good little Christian, and I'm not getting it. But the world's not dead to me. The world's screaming, Wayne, come over here. I'm going, can't hear you. You know what I mean? What I've discovered in the last few years of my life, this righteousness right here is not so fragile. Why? Whose hands is it in? It's not in my hands. It's in His. Jesus can go in. Jesus did. He went everywhere. He didn't say, I can't go be with sinners because I'll get enticed into sin. I can't go do that. I can't be with religious people because I'll get sucked into religion. He hung out with religious people. He hung out with sinners and heathens. He just hung out in the culture. And wherever He came in the culture, to the individual He was with, He crawled into their world, didn't He? He didn't ask them to crawl into His. He didn't say, this is how you should think, this is what you should do. He started with wherever they were. The incarnation, for Pete's sakes, is the greatest statement of that. God took on human form to live among us, to make Himself known. He came into our world, in our language, on our terms, to touch us. If we don't learn to do that, people, if we don't learn to do that, we become dangerous Christians to the work of God in people around us. And I'd like to submit two cases in point. The first, Job's advisors. Remember the book of Job? Oh boy, that's a confusing book. One of these days I'm going to write a book on the book of Job, and it's going to be the 10 stupid things we say to hurting people. Because that's it. Now, these were good guys. These guys crawled into Job's little pit and fasted with him in sackcloth and ashes for 7 days before they ever said a word. So don't think these are poorly intentioned people. They were not. They agonize with poor Job, losing his family, losing his wealth, losing everything. And they crawl into that with him, and they cry with him, and they fast with him for 7 days. And then they start trying to help him. Oh, and their help is so pathetic. Basically, the theme of their whole conversation with Job is this. If you're hurting, it's because you've done something wrong, and God's punishing you for it. Now, we already know from the story that this, what Job's going through, has nothing to do with his personal sin, don't we? Nothing to do with his own failure. In fact, if anything, it's instigated by his righteousness. Because God's sitting up there saying, hey, Dan, you seen Job? He's a great guy. And Satan says, yeah, it's only great because you're blessing him, and if you stop blessing him, he'd reject you. And God says, no, I don't think so. But go ahead and try. I'm just like, you know what? God, I don't want you talking to the devil for me about stuff like that. Just leave it alone. Yes, it's only because you're nice to me. I'm cool with that. So however this works out, Job gets just leveled. And these guys keep saying, man, you done wrong. And Job says, no, I didn't. And this is the whole book of Job. Yes, you did. No, I didn't. Yes, you did. No, I didn't. That's 36 chapters of that. Yeah, a little more detail, but that's pretty much it. 36 chapters. Yes, you did. No, I didn't. Yes, you did. No, I didn't. God's evil. No, he's not. Yes, he is. No, he's not. And this is on and on and on. And that was Job. Job just saying, look, I didn't earn this. So if you only hurt when you do bad, I didn't do bad. I shouldn't be hurting. Therefore, God must be wrong. And then the advisors say, but if you're saying God's evil, that's your evil. See, that's it. That's why you're in the pain you're in. They were not helpful, were they? Even incredibly well-intentioned people who do a lot in terms of personal empathy to get there, who don't get there, who don't get into your world and understand your journey and understand God's work in the world and how God works with people, and in fact that God doesn't reserve suffering for those that deserve it. That the rain falls on the just and the unjust. That part of being in this world means bad stuff happens to us and God overcomes in us whatever it is that we face. And we don't have just the closer you walk with God, the greater guarantee you have of nothing going wrong and you not getting sick and you not getting in an accident and your kids not doing this and that. I mean, it's just the whole lie that if we get the God thing right, our lives will be unchallenged is the greatest lie that we're being told today. Among the greatest lies. Let me tell you this. If Job's advisors, and you know the end of the story. The end of the story is God just shows up and says, what are you talking about? Where were you when I made the heavens? Where were you when I separated the land from the sea? Where were you? And now you think you know better? You guys think you know? And Job's final words are this. I'm sorry, God. I said stuff I should have never said because I didn't understand things too wonderful for me to comprehend. When God finally gets his hands around Job again, Job is not struck by God's capriciousness, by God's malevolence, by God's anything other than God's wonder. Job just sits back and says, oh my gosh, this was more wonderful than I knew. Do you hear Ephesians 3:20 in there somewhere? Beyond anything we could ask or ever imagine, according to the power that works within us. That God does not take your agenda for your life and fulfills it as a way of blessing you. In fact, what God takes your agenda for your life and pretty much disappoints it so that he can bless you. But we don't feel blessed when he's disappointing it. Doggone it. I thought when I got saved, somebody said God had a wonderful plan for my life. He does. It's just not your plan. It's just not how you want to get there. It's not what you want to see done. Job's advisors come into this moment and unable to get into Job's world, unable to meet him where he is and be what Job needs to find God's light. Little Elihu comes along toward the end. Read what Elihu says, because that's the meat of the book of Job. That and God's words. God's words are pretty good too. Advisor stuff, they ain't got a clue what's going on. Job, nope, hasn't got a clue what's going on. Elihu comes up and says, what are you guys all talking for God for? Don't you know God's bigger than all of you? And this is like really dumb stuff to be doing. And then he goes, whoa, look what I see. I see God coming. See you later. And then a big whirlwind shows up, and then God's having it. Job, that's the best stuff in Job. See, they didn't get it. They couldn't get into someone's world. And because they couldn't get into someone's world, they made Job's suffering worse for Job. Just read to you a moment when Jesus is telling his disciples about what's to happen to him when he gets to Jerusalem here in Mark 10. I could also read you from Matthew chapter 16. After this wonderful moment, we've shared it before, it's one of my favorite passages too. Hey guys, who do people say that I am? Oh, some say you're Elijah, and some say you're Moses, and some say, well, who do you say that I am? And Peter, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Oh, man, he nails it. He just knocks it out of the ballpark. And Jesus, it's a wonderful moment, because in Jesus, because Peter, you know, do you notice Peter basically never got anything right? Never. The one he hits out of the ballpark, he got it. Got that pitch, took it out of the ballpark, and Jesus says, whoa, Peter. What'd he say? Flesh and blood hasn't revealed this to you, but my Father who's in heaven. So the one thing he does do well, he just, whoa, that was a God moment. That was not a Peter moment. Peter's not that bright. And you know, would it be okay with you if you don't have to be that bright to walk in this kingdom? See, I don't think that's a slam on Peter at all. I think this is a great exaltation of who God is and who he wants to be in us. You don't have to be that bright to do this. You don't have to be well-knowledged. You don't have to get it all down. You don't have to be flawless. You just have to be hanging out with God. Hanging out with him. And Peter has a real God moment. You're the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus says, wow, God moment. Peter, you're a rock, and upon this rock I'll build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. And I mean, Peter is riding high on the saddle right about now. He went from being just about wrong on everything to nailed the big final super question for the, you know, 25,000 bonus points. And then Jesus talks about, I'm going to go up to Jerusalem. I'm going to be delivered up to the elders. I'm going to be crucified on the cross. I'm going to raise again on the third day. And what does Peter say now? Do you remember? What does he say? Huh? God forbid it, Lord. Now, there's a prayer for you. God, work against yourself, please. Because he's praying to God about the Lord being wrong. We're really funny when we respond out of fear, but Peter's responding out of fear. He just heard his best friend's going to die. And then Jesus turns to him and says, get behind me, Satan. How do you go in less than 30 seconds from being the rock to Satan? I mean, just, whoa, that was a flat. Okay, there's a God moment. Here's a Peter moment. And it's all wrapped up in the same. I don't really believe just what I understand about the nature of Jesus. I don't think he's calling Peter Satan, to be honest with you. I think he recognizes Satan in Peter's words. As he recognized God in Peter's earlier words, now he recognized Satan in Peter's words. He's still loving. You know that Jesus is really okay with this? He's not like, Peter, how could you say such a thing? You are. He just says, hey, Satan, get behind me. I'm not listening to that. Because you know what? We find out later, Jesus is not real excited about the cross. He's not like, oh, whoopee ding, the cross. Yeah, can't wait. Not excited. Not excited about this. The pain of it. And you know, I don't even think it was the pain of it. You've heard me teach on the cross before, some of you. It was what happened in God that I think, for this becoming sin itself, the wrath of God consuming sin in the Son on the cross. I think that is what Jesus is concerned. I don't think Jesus is worried about the nails so much. Though the nails couldn't have been, you know, whoopee ding, let's do that. That sounds fun. Or the scourging or the crown. I mean, as horrible as that stuff was, and I don't mean to minimize it, what I am telling you is there was something far worse that happened on the cross than the pain that humans executed towards him. It was becoming sin itself. It was the wrath of God curing sin in the Son, so that you and I can be the righteousness of God in Christ Jesus, as that blood now purified because it's been made complete. The work of God, the wrath of God, which is not God's anger, I'm going to slap you upside the head. God's wrath is God's love. It's as I've said to you before, it is the full weight of God's being brought against that which destroys the object of his affection. That's wrath. It's not God's wrath and God's love. It's God's love. Compassion is part of it. And wrath is part of the same love. Same thing. But that had to work in Christ until sin was fully consumed, in the words of Romans 8. So he's not looking forward to the moment. Peter's words now, again, well-intentioned people. Job's advisors, Peter here. Well-intentioned people can be incredibly destructive people. That needs to sink home. Not as added weight and pressure. It's just saying, you know what, God? I don't want to be one of those. I have been one of those. I have been in more circumstances than I would care to enumerate with you. One of the great joys I'm seeing about what God's been doing in my life in the last number of years is that I don't look back at the end of a year or a few months' time and have a lot of regret about conversations I was in. I used to all the time. Things I thought, man, I really know the right deal here, and I'm trying to make it happen, and I'm hurting people instead of helping them. I used to have a lot of that litter in my past. I do it to the end of a year now, and I just don't have a lot of those, thankfully. I have a desire now to get into someone else's world, and how do we get there? How do we get there? And I think what Jesus says to Peter at the end of Matthew 16, what I just said to you about, you know what, Peter? You're looking out for man's interests, not God's interests. He that saves his life will lose it. He that loses it for my sake will find it. What he's really saying to Peter is, as long as you are going to take care of you, this is what's going to happen. And your best intentions are going to hurt people. But what he offers us is this ability to lose our life. Now, what does that mean? See, we think it means, you know, like dying to the flesh. And in some sense it is, but it really isn't that gross. It's not that bad a process. I got an email from someone I spent the weekend with this last weekend back in Phoenix. And as a couple that had been on my website, so I was going to be there, wrote me and said, hey, we'd like to meet you. And I said, well, call the people and see if they don't mind you coming up. And because I wasn't doing like a public seminar kind of thing. I was just hanging out in some homes with some folks, and we were talking about the Jesus stuff. And he and his wife came up, and he said, you know what? We used to think this dying to sin was this horribly painful process. We went away this weekend knowing we died to some things this weekend that God put to death in us. And it was the funnest weekend we've ever had. Come on, that's cool. I don't know how they got all that, but I'm like, that's cool. I think that's a God thing. They recognize something, God. Something died in us, and it was fun. And so we've had some stuff in us die this week, and we have enjoyed it. We have enjoyed God in the middle of it. Now, I think that's the gospel. I think that's what he means. When you give up your life, when it's no longer yours to save, when you have nothing left to gain, nothing left to prove, and nothing left to lose, now you're really ready to be a vessel for God in the world and with other believers. As long as we still have something to gain. You know what drove me nuts about teenagers in my house? And I was really grateful when we finally threw them out. We called it college, but we finally got them out. Little kids, you can do stuff like, let's have a family night. And, oh, yeah. And you do teenagers, let's have a talk. I don't feel like talking. Well, we noticed though, with young kids, you can pretty much let them live in your world. You can get them, because they're young and stupid, to live in your world. And then when they figure out some about 11, 12, 13, that they are sentient beings, and they do have a will, and it runs counter to yours as the parent, then, you know, engaging my children was not about getting them ready to engage me when I was ready. It was I needed to be ready when they were ready. You get that? It was in their time, in their world. And they would come home and, you know, say, hey, want to talk to you sometime? How you doing? You know, take them out to dinner. We're going to have these serious, wonderful family talk kinds of things. Dead. We're talking. They're going, yeah, hell. What about this? Oh, I don't care. They weren't non-communicative. But then there are those moments where they come home from something where they just want to talk your leg off. They just, and usually it was when I was going to bed. Or I had a meeting to get to. And now my son, who is not all that talkative, is... And I'm like going, do I leave this? See, and I left some of those things. You know, son, can you hold that? When I get back from this meeting, we'll talk about that. And then I'd come back from the meeting. How well did it go? It didn't. You know what? It just didn't. Hey, Andy, let's talk. I don't feel like it, Dad. And what I began to realize through that time, if I was going to have a relationship with my kids post-adolescence, post them thinking they were sentient beings, I needed to live in their time, not ask them to live in mine. That was the most incredible lesson. And so it was, you know, it drives us nuts. Kids come home from college, And you just, you know, are they going to go with their friends tonight for dinner? Or are they not? Are they going to be here? We don't know. If we ask them at 3, what are you guys doing for dinner tonight? I don't know yet, because they're going to decide at 5:45 what they're going to do about dinner. And so Sarah and I are like hanging around going, okay, we got stuff. We can make it for them if they're staying. If not, we're cool, because we'll just have dinner with each other. But we're trying to, the last possible moment, because we're going to. And it drives you nuts to live like that. We were always grateful when I went back to college. Good, go back, go away. But if you want to engage adolescents, if you want to engage teens, you engage them in their world. You don't engage them in your own. And you know what? I not only learned that from my kids, I learned that about every human being I meet. The most effective moment is to be there in their time, to be there in their language. This, I really want you, here's how practical I want this to soak into your lives. As you give testimony in places you give testimonies in, and I've heard some of your testimonies, incredible stories of God's working in you, be aware of this, and maybe you already are. But what you might share in the first apostolic screaming charismatic church of Kansas may be different than what you share at the first Catholic church or something else. And I don't mean you tell a different story. You know, here you were a Presbyterian that got saved, and here you were a Catholic that got saved. You know, don't change the facts. I'm not saying that. I'm talking about the language that we use. If you're with a charismatic group of people, or, you know, evangelical, pretty much you can talk about, you know, God said this to me and God said that to me. And people understand what that means. You say that in other contexts and you're closing doors, because people are like, God said to them, God's speaking to them. And, you know, you don't have time to fix all that theologically. And so you may say, you know what, I just felt like I had this thought that God put in my heart. That will pass muster with people, that God said won't with some. And what you really, what this begs us to do, and I love this language of Ephesians 4, I think it's like 24 or 20, or I think it's 24, where Paul says, he talks about our mouth and not using our mouth to tear down, but that which gives grace to who? The hearer. Most conversations were in, see, I used to not be able to remember anybody's name. I'd meet somebody, and then as I'm walking away from the conversation, I'm going, who was that? I don't remember the name. Now, you guys don't count. A lot of your names I forget, because I only see you like every few months. And so I'm still working on the name thing with some of you. But now, I used to, when I'm meeting somebody, I'm more aware about, you know, not tripping over my own name and saying something stupid. Or I was so aware of me that I wasn't picking up anything going on with them. And I didn't go through any memory course or anything like that. But I find I remember people's names much easier now that I meet. Because I'm really much more aware of them. Now, I didn't do that. I didn't choose to say, okay, I'm going to be much more aware of other people now. I'm going to work hard at this. Remember what I said yesterday? This is not acting. This is transformation. When Jesus shows you how much he's going to watch your backside, he's that's like the partner in law enforcement. He's got your back. When you know Jesus has your back, you can be in any circumstance not thinking what you need to get out of it. Not worried about what bed you're going to sleep in, what food you're going to get, how you're going to look, how it's going to... Now you can be totally engaged with the hearer. Person you're next with. Language that they understand. I don't talk the same language to you guys that I'm going to talk to the lady from the State Department of Education in her car driving back to Sacramento. This is going to be different language totally, because there are jargonish Christian jargon that you and I are comfortable with. We've grown up around it. We understand it. When I say it, you get it. And when you say it, I get it. But when I'm at the world, they speak a whole other language. They don't talk about righteousness and sin. They may talk about being good and failing. The language changes, because the focus is I want the hearer to get it. It's not that I said it well. See, as a writer, I know I can say something incredibly well and the person who read it not get it. And I can say, well, it's their fault because I wrote it incredibly well. No, it's not. If I can't put it in language they can grasp, the real focus is not have I said it well. It's did it communicate well? Was it heard? And what Paul asks us to evaluate in Ephesians 4 is, did it give grace to the hearer? And if it didn't give grace to the hearer, if you know, and just if that person, after we've, if they didn't become more aware of grace, then it didn't matter if I said it right. It didn't matter if it was theologically sound. What matters is I blew the moment, and I didn't encourage them further on the journey. If I impart guilt for grace, even where I know they're wrong, and I'm going to talk about that more tonight, if I'm giving guilt where grace needs to be, I am not drawing... See, here's the thing we thought. We thought guilt, shame, draws people closer to Christ. See, what Jesus knew is guilt and shame pushes people further away from who he really is. It does push people on this journey. Guilt and shame, you can make people respond to stuff and look better on the outside when they're responding to guilt and shame because they have approval needs. And if you're going to give them approval, if they conform to your expectations, some people will do that for a while. It looks incredibly effective. But it doesn't work on that journey. It doesn't work over here. People that we're wanting to engage in, because our shame and our sense of incompetence and our guilt about our failures is that which seems to drive a wall between us and Christ. The wall that the cross was meant to obliterate, that Jesus Christ is, as we'll talk about tonight, the safest person for any of these people to be with and the safest person for you to be with at your moments of worst pain, worst struggle, worst need. The passion that I'm talking to you about is God brings us into this moment to make you a person that can really be one in whom Christ takes shape, is one that's willing to meet other people on their terms, that you are their servant, they're not yours. It's not for you to conform them to even your godly expectations, but for you to love them where they're at, that somehow they might see Christ in you. And having seen Christ in you, be drawn to know him better and be transformed by him. There's nothing more important in that process than you and I coming to the end of our own self-consciousness. And that, that may sound easy, but if we really stop and talk about it, just don't be self-conscious anymore. How many of you are good at that? Like a self-conscious is something you can turn on and off. I think I'll just be self-conscious today and tomorrow. I don't think I will be. I think I'll just turn it off. I think it's this. I think we're self-conscious to the degree that we're not Jesus conscious. So I think self-consciousness is like darkness. You don't go into a room and decide, you know what, it's dark in here. I think I'm going to chase the dark out. And if you want to try this tonight, go ahead. Shut all the lights off in your room and then just like try and chase all the dark out of the room. Go away. I want to be light in here. It doesn't go anywhere, does it? I think self-consciousness is like that. You can say, you know, I'm not going to be it anymore, and it doesn't change. You can't chase it out of your life. What you can say is, Jesus, I want you to show me you so well that I'm more conscious of you than I am me. See, it's not, Jesus, take my self-consciousness away. What is that? Take the dark away. No, bring light here. You go in that room, you don't chase out darkness, you turn on a light. You don't chase out self-consciousness. You say to God, wherever you recognize it, whenever you realize you got in a circumstance and you were more aware of what you wanted out of it than you were what others wanted out of it, then say, Jesus, man, I need to know you. I need to know that you've got my backside. I need to know that everything about my life today is in your hands. And everything is... I need experience. I've got about eight book ideas that I've been shuttling around that I want to write before I die. And I'll probably have next year another 16 on top of that. So I know I'm not going to get them all done, but I just want to. And just had a mess with some publishing commitments that we had, and people backed out of it the last minute. And you just got to know. Well, I'm glad you didn't, but if you knew me about 10 years ago, disappointed expectations just absolutely devastated me. I mean, I get angry, yell at Sarah, yell at the kids. It's frightful. I'd throw manuscripts away in the trash can, and Sarah would empty the trash can and always look for manuscripts in there and hold them and dump the whole trash can out in the trash and then put my manuscript in the bottom of the trash can and put it back in my office because she knew I'd want it eventually. She was so sweet. She wouldn't do that today. She would just say, you lost it, buddy. Throw it in the trash. It's gone. She's a nicer woman, but different, a little different. And went through some real disappointing stuff. And Sarah says, man, boy, that's sad. I thought they were going to. I said, you know what? That's not what God had. Said, really? You know that? I said, well, no. If it was what God had, it would have been. So God's got something out. And this is going to sound freaky to you. I don't like telling freaky stories like this, but I just got to tell you the story. I think he wants me to, or I wouldn't. We just in the last 3 weeks have had some incredible news about some publishing opportunities and some people that I really want to publish with. And I'm just incredibly excited about that. It was better than what we had in process a few months ago when I was when I could have been so disappointed. And I genuinely wasn't. And
when all that broke one morning, I got off a phone call. It was from the East Coast, so people on the East Coast. Somebody from the East Coast? You know, we're 3 hours behind you guys. If you call us at 9 in the morning, what time is it for us? See, yeah, some people don't know that. And so they call me about 6, and I'm on the phone. Hey, we want to offer you this contract, blah, 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 blah. And I'm going, man, that is so cool. So I'm in the shower just telling God, thank you. This is so much better than we were even talking about a few months ago. I am so grateful you've opened this door, blah, 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 blah. And when I got done just telling God how grateful I was, I think this is what he said to me. I could almost swear it. Here's what I heard in my heart. And I'm really glad you didn't freak out this time. I went, oh my gosh, isn't that cool? I freaked out my whole life. Every time God didn't do what I wanted, I freaked out. Got mad, all frustrated, all torn up inside. Oh, I must be missing God. God doesn't love me. You know what? This time I didn't freak out. I was sitting in the airport I was supposed to leave the airport in Phoenix on Sunday afternoon at 5:30, arrive LAX 6:40, and drive home by 8 to spend a couple hours with Sarah, whom I've been gone from all weekend. I get to the airport, and our flight's still in Los Angeles, and it's not coming inbound, and they start lying to us about when the flight's going to leave, and they've got it posted for 6:50. We found out later the plane didn't even leave Los Angeles until 7:15, and we're asking, is that pretty accurate? Yes, that's working. So they lied to us, they delayed us. We didn't actually leave Phoenix until like 8:30, and I didn't get home until 11:30. Sarah's already asleep, and that stuff used to just really tick me off. I'd be sitting at the airport just feeling, what the going on? Well, I can't run a decent airline. And I'm sitting there thinking about why I'm not mad. I'm sitting there going, why am I not really ticked? I should be ticked. These guys are lying to us. Got this plane not coming in. They're saying it coming in. They could have put me on the earlier flight like I asked them to. And they said it was full. And then I found out it went out with 3 seats empty. I mean, this could have been so different. I'm going, I should really be ticked. Why am I not ticked? I kept asking myself, why am I not? This is the kind of thing that fries my bacon. And I'm just sitting there going, I got stuff to read, people to talk to, and I'm not going to see Sarah tonight. But, you know, there's something that I just kept. And I tried to get angry for a while, thinking I want to get really angry and go up there and just give them a piece of my mind. And I just started laughing because I couldn't do it. I just couldn't make myself mad enough to go and yell at them. I've just always yelled at them. I just think that's why they put people at those counters, just to be yelled at. That's. I tell you what, I was laughing. I got home late. I didn't, you know, Sarah was already asleep. And I disappointed, sure. Was it a big deal? Wasn't a big deal. Because God's called us to be servants in the age. You can't be a servant till you lose your sense of self-consciousness. The whole world is in orbit around you. Oh, so ministry's still about you, Wayne? Oh, man, yes, it is. Now I'm finding it, not so much. As I said the other day, not perfect in any of the things I'm talking to you about, but so much freer than I ever used to be. Going to a home, got a meal coming, got something going, not what I like, not what I want. I didn't care anymore. Is not this every bit of this day in Father's hands? Is not the publisher I work with or not? If I never publish another book, is that in his hands or my hands? And boy, when you realize it's in his, when you realize that everything about your life is in his hands, he brings it about in his time, his way, and when you're free enough to know that, you can be involved in every circumstance, not for what you want, need, got to have, but what others need, got to have. In fact, I pretty much now enjoy more stuff when I'm not in charge. I used to be a control freak. I want to be in charge of the deal. Now I like showing up at somebody else's retreat, somebody else's this, somebody else's that. Man, I like not being in control anymore. I like it's not my job. I'm just here to help. What do you need? I'm going to help. The greatest among you will be the servant of all. I just think the whole freedom of no longer having to please myself. That's a horrible tyranny. Peter calls it the tyranny of self. The tyranny of always having to have life your own way. It's a tyranny. And the greatest freedom I'm knowing now in Jesus is, it doesn't have to be my way. What God's going to do in me, he's going to do. You're not going to get in the way of it. You can't stop it. He's going to make it happen his way, his time. Not the way I want. Not in my time necessarily. He'll do it. And because I'm so convinced he's doing that, I'm so convinced of his approval for my life, just as his son that he loves, not because I'm perfect, just because he's nuts about me. and he's nuts about you. Just because of that, I'm safe. If I get stuck in Phoenix a few more hours, it's not the end of the world. That's not a choice I made. I sit there like I'm really angry. I'm going to try not to be. I'm just sitting there laughing at myself because I'm not ready to kill that poor lady behind that counter. I never really killed any before, not physically, but did give them a piece of my mind when I felt like they'd been less than honest with me. When you're ready to love that way, you're safe for God to put anybody in your pathway. Anybody. The worst sinner, the meanest person. And you can be there not to get walked on. I'm going to talk a little bit about that tonight. I don't think being the servant of all means, yeah, you get to be a doormat for everybody who walks on you. That's not what Jesus was for anybody. But neither was he the guy in the circumstance being served. Yeah, I want you to do this for me. I want you to praise me. I want you to go do what I want. What can I do for you? Enter into their world at that moment. Be tuned into the frequency that other people are on and ask God to help you do it. But how do I find words that make sense to this person? Not how do I share what I've always shared with everybody, like everybody in the world is the same, and they're not the same. They're very different. And God, how can you in this moment make me someone who can go into their world and just help? I went recently to Atlanta, and I really don't enjoy telling some of these stories because they're not that big a deal to me, except what I've seen God do in my life. I went to Atlanta to be with a group of folks, and we had a meeting Friday night, and in the middle, at the end of that, one of the ladies that was there, a single mom, stood up and she said, you know, tomorrow I'm leaving for Jacksonville and moving away, and she'd been part of this group for a long time, and so they prayed for her and schmoozed up on her, and, you know, we're going to miss you and love you and all that good stuff, and then we dismissed, and she happened to be walking by me, so I, you know, hi, and mentioned her name because she'd, you know, shared who she was, and I just casually just said, are you all set for moving tomorrow? She said, well, I think I've got one person to help me. I said, one person? I said, how much you got to move? She said, well, we're packing up, you know, a two-bedroom house. You got one person? One? She said, yeah. And so I was staying with a guy named Charles. I looked over Charles and said, what are we doing tomorrow morning? He said, well, I thought we'd play golf or something. You know, we got the morning off, do whatever we want. I said, what about we help Heather here move? And he goes, my gosh, I want to do that earlier in the week, but I knew you were at my house. Didn't think you'd want to. You want to move her? I said, she needs help. I'm not at home where I've got kids and lawns to mow and stuff to do and things, and I don't have anything. I said, yeah, let's get up. And so we got up at 6 in the morning, went over and helped her pack her stuff and got her off to Jacksonville. And when I got back that night to the group, everybody in the group knew that the sneaker from out of town had gone to move this single woman, and they were all embarrassed. They were like ashamed. They were like, oh my gosh, I can't believe you did that, and you shouldn't have been doing that. That's what we should have been doing, and we were so busy with our own lives. And I said, whoa, what are you guys doing to me? I was free. I had nothing to do. Saturday morning, I'm long ways from home. I had nothing. It was really, I mean, it wasn't even a big deal for me, and I don't like moving people, but it just wasn't a big deal. But you know what? The email I've gotten since that trip from those people, what I said, all this, and I taught great stuff. I mean, you know I've got stuff. Man, that was great stuff. Nothing I said held a candle to that one little thing I did and how it worked. And I might release them from the whole shame thing. I don't get all that. But you know what they were saying? We really are just focused on ourselves. We really aren't looking beyond our own needs in life. And I mean, God did a great thing through that, but I didn't do it for that. I didn't. This is the best. That you can be so free from you. Now, don't think it's going to happen tomorrow afternoon. We're going to get all that squared away tonight. You know, prayer time. You'll be all free of you and everything's going to be great. Well, I want to just reiterate as I close what I said yesterday. This is a journey for a lifetime. Okay? Y'all pretty young. Probably still wrapped up a lot in you. Met me when I was 41. You'd say, man, it's the most selfish guy I've ever been around. Hey, some people actually did say stuff like that. So I know that's true. I just wish that what I knew now, I'd known 30 years ago. I do. I don't know that I would have gotten there any quicker. I'm pretty thick, pretty dense, but I love the process. I want you to love it. I want you to let God change you. You're not going to be perfect beginning of this summer or the end of it or the end of your tour or when you're 45. This is a lifetime journey, but you know what? This is the best journey. And it's not so pick and fragile that you have to make everything serve you. It's so secure in Him that you can be all the servant Jesus wants you to be in the world. To each other and to anybody you happen upon in the course of the journey. Amen? Father, thank you for your grace and your goodness. Lord, capture us with who you are. Where we don't know that you have our backside, I pray you would show us that you have it. Show us. Ways we don't deserve, in places where we have not earned a thing, and yet suddenly your goodness is revealed. And we go, oh my goodness, I can't trust him. He really is amazing. But I want you to convince these people of that. And me. More every day from now till the end of the age. That because our life is so completely secure in you, I can live this day. Not putting me first. Not thinking about what I need. Letting you handle that. While I just look for ways to bless other folks today. Somehow, God, make it so real in us. Set us free to that kind of life and together in Jesus' name. Amen.